A question had arisen on the subject of another edition, another translation of the Wittgenstein's Tractatus, what they call the Tractatus. It's not the original book, of course. The original title, which was written in German by Wittgenstein, was Logisch Philosophisch Abhandlung. And somewhere or other I got a letter from Wittgenstein saying to Ogden, he doesn't know what that means. And he much prefers Ogden's title for the English edition, which was Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. And it's from that that the impression has arisen that the title was invented by a man who wrote about common sense and philosophy. Oh dear. I don't believe that he invented the title. I think Ogden invented the title Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which has now become the title to Wittgenstein's work and is always referred to as such, although Wittgenstein never used it. He never wrote such a book. It may be that G. Moore suggested a title which led Ogden to adopt this phrase. There's no book by Spinoza called Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. This is a Tractatus that he wrote. And it's really a suggestion of Moore's taken up by Ogden and perfected. But everybody thinks that it was Moore's suggestion, because for some reason or other, there's a down on Ogden in the philosophical world, and they down him whenever they can, and they won't give him credit for anything. For example, when the publishers asked Ogden, then alive, hardly alive, it was in the 50s, because he died in 57, not in 62. Would he agree to another translation into English of the Tractatus, on the ground that perhaps his was rather old-fashioned in style? He said, well, by all means, but it'd be odd, wouldn't it, to have two translations of the same book in the same publisher's list? Why don't you have it? By all means do it, but have Blackwell or somebody like that publish it. But Routledge didn't want that. They wanted to have their hands on the whole thing. And they got a couple called Pears and McGuinness, Oxford philosophers, I think, to write this translation, or perhaps it had been written and submitted to them, and it's... I can't judge it to be better, worse, or otherwise. I can only say this, that Ogden's translation was first of all shot off by Professor Ramsey, not Professor Ramsey, Ramsey the philosopher, the elder brother of the Archbishop, who was a genius, a mathematician, and whose German was such that he could actually translate by dictation. And Ogden called him in for a first draft. Then Ogden worked on the draft with the help of others, and directly with the help of Wittgenstein. There was a long correspondence between him and Wittgenstein, which I've got in Wittgenstein's own fist, saying why such and such a word should be translated in such and such a way, even though the translator Ogden had given the English more literally, and the more literal translation. He said, you know, I want this to be an expression of my opinions in English, not just a literal translation of what I said in German. We publish the German on one page and the English on the other, and then people who know both languages will see what's behind it all. I'm trying to give the English reader, he was saying in effect, what I'm thinking as if I were thinking in English. And his English, according to Russell, was very good. His philosophical English, certainly. He mightn't be able to spell very well, but that didn't matter. And there was a long discussion about whether this new translation should come. And as long as Ogden was around, and he was the editor of the series in which this thing was to come, was to be published, Ogden stopped it. He said, no, you can't do it. Not in this way, not in the way you wish. But the minute he died, there was tremendous pressure put upon the trustee, upon the executors, whom I was one, to get this translation out. And we opposed it on the grounds that we'd seen all this correspondence, you see, on the grounds that he'd given. But they pushed it through nonetheless. To his credit, Russell came to Ogden's defence, in defence of his memory, and said that things that had been said about his translation were untrue, that Wittgenstein went through it line by line and word for word, and that it was exactly as he wanted it, and it was indeed described as the authorized translation in English. Whether the second translation is good, bad, or indifferent is neither here nor there, but there's a great deal of it that comes out of Ogden's, perhaps not deliberately, perhaps by accident the words are exactly the same. There are many of them, many phrases which are exactly the same. It's more polished. But then I don't know that Wittgenstein's German was polished. Wittgenstein himself was the polished speaker or writer. He was a strong writer, I gather, in the original German. And the English has an Old Testament flavour about it, which adds to its attraction. Wittgenstein was that kind of a man. Well, as part of the fight before all this happened, Ogden apparently had received a letter from Hayek, who was then in America, in 55. And Hayek says, I had indeed nearly completed the rough draft of a long biographical article more than a year ago, which I then put aside when Ludwig Wittgenstein's executors refused permission to use his letters to Bertrand Russell until they had published them themselves. Now, Hayek was a relation of Wittgenstein's, a sort of a first, a second or third cousin. He knew the family very well. He knew Wittgenstein. And he wanted to do a sketch of him, a biographical sketch. His executors stopped it. Wittgenstein's executors, rather, stopped it. And this letter is written some 4 years after Wittgenstein died. Now, I wonder why they stopped it. The result is that Hayek's book has never been published, though it was written. Seems odd, doesn't it?
So, what were the circumstances leading up to the publication of your letters between Ogden and Wittgenstein?
Well, there was a furious argument in the columns of the Times Literary Supplement, which started in this way. The new translation came out, and it came out with the preface which Bertrand Russell wrote for Ogden's original translation. When it came out, it was reviewed anonymously. To this day, I don't know. Nobody seems to know. I suppose, of course, the Times know who he was. Whoever reviewed it took most of the article, as far as I recall, I can show it to you if you want to see it, I've got it here somewhere, took up most of the article in not so much praising or showing why the new translation was better than the old one, but in lambasting the old one and saying it was high time the damn thing was done away with. It was no good, you see. Well, that was an annoying thing to do to his executors. First of all, it ought never to have been published. If Ogden had been alive, he'd have stopped it in the way it was published. Secondly, if the translators had had an opportunity to see the correspondence between Ogden and Wittgenstein when that translation was made, they would themselves not have fallen into many blunders. And in any event, what was the point of taking it out of Ogden without giving him credit as being the man who put it across at a time when Wittgenstein simply wasn't known at all? And but for that English translation, it would not have been known. So I got hit up and wrote to the Times and told the Literary Supplement, and they published this letter, and it started a correspondence. The translator was offhand about the whole thing. The reviewer, rather, still not disclosing who he was quite offhand, but not entirely honest about it, I thought. He gave no real answer to my criticism. And then one of Wittgenstein's executors, Miss Anscombe, who is a philosopher of considerable note and now occupies the chair of philosophy at Cambridge that Wittgenstein and Russell formerly occupied, wrote a furious letter to the editor saying, complaining that he had published my letter in which I had quoted from Wittgenstein's letters to Ogden, not denying the quotes on their aptness to the argument, but complaining that the editor had no right to publish them without asking her permission as the owner of the copyright, as Wittgenstein's executor. Very funny. And complaining that we were stopping the publication, you see, of all these papers. But of course, it was she who was stopping them. She couldn't stop me quoting. Well, this went on for months. It went on for years, in fact. Luckily, another executor, of Wittgenstein's executors came to see me. He's a Finn, Hendrik von Wright, Professor Hendrik von Wright, who was a pupil, who was an undergraduate, or perhaps a postgraduate, who sat at the feet of Wittgenstein, you see, and knew him well, one of his executors. And we got along fine. He was obviously straight, obviously an honest man. All he wanted to do was to get the thing right. I showed him Wittgenstein's letters. He sat for hours in the office looking over them and said, well, of course we must withdraw what we said about Ogden's translation not being correct and about it being bad and all the rest of it. It's really wrong. It should never have been said. I can only tell you that Wittgenstein, many years afterwards, gave the impression that he never saw the proofs, and so we said so. But of course, obviously, either he forgot or he was just being naughty. And so he at once apologized in the press. And out of that interview arose this idea of getting all these letters out, and also the corrections on the manuscript that in Wittgenstein's own hand. It took a long time to do, because then I got Blackwell's to do it, and then Routledge came along and said they wanted a hand in it, and Blackwell's being peaceful sort of people said, well, let's do it jointly, and I agreed. And finally, long, long last, it got out with the handsome apology in it that von Wright put in the preface, vindicating Ogden absolutely. And as I say, it came out last year, didn't it? Yes, I think it was last year. A long time afterwards, you know, considering Ogden died in 57. That's 15 years to vindicate a man. Still, it's worth it. dead men can't come back to refute libels, but it's nice to be able to put them right, however long. You know, in the academic world, there's no doubt about it, that if a thing gets around, a rumour of that sort, that Ogden was in some way or other not above board in that translation, it sticks.
Yes.
And you've got to stop it. It does a man a lot of harm in his reputation. And I felt it had to be done, and I'm very glad I did it. No matter how long it took.
So, what effect did publishing the letters have on the second translation, as it's very evident from the letters how closely Ogden and Wittgenstein must have collaborated during the original translation?
Well, everybody now knows two things. The first is that if they're going to understand, if they want to study what was in Wittgenstein's German mind for the English people to know about his book, they can only do it from Ogden's translation. This is Wittgenstein in English, not Ogden in English, and there's no question about that. What the second translation did was to polish up, insofar as they thought the thing, that their translation was correct. Though in many ways it's absolutely contrary to what Wittgenstein wanted to say, as is clear from that book. But they've polished it up and put it in a more modern and more polished style. But you know, it loses a lot, in it seems to me. I don't know that the student is any better off reading the new translation than the old one. He's worse off if he wants to know what really Wittgenstein really thought at the time. I suppose there's place for both of them. But it ought not to have been done in that way. It would have been far better for the later translators to have had a chance to get at these things. And of course, they did send a series of questions to me, asking why did Ogden translate such and such in such and such a way, things of that sort. And we were quite ready to help, but said, look, we'd better come along and see all these things first, and at the same time, let us see if we can't clear up these libels on Ogden, but two of Wittgenstein's executors have published in other works, namely that Ogden's translation was not reliable and that Wittgenstein told the executors that he'd never seen the proofs. Well, here's the evidence that it's absolutely false, whether Wittgenstein forgot or what. Oh, the letters are absolutely, when they finally saw them, von Wright, Professor von Wright saw them, he apologized immediately. But all that should have been done before the second translation was published, and it could have been done together, do you see, made one book of it. But whether it was because the new translators were anxious to get it out, or the publishers were pushing them, or there was a deadline to meet, I don't know what the reason was. There was certainly a lot of crowding and pushing. Nothing came of their overtures to us to help, they didn't get the answers to their questions, which would have helped them not to blunder and make the most awful mistakes in many ways. And there it is, it leaves right, left a rather nasty taste in the mouth. These little things happen. These cards that you see here, what are there, about a dozen of them? Black, white on black, enormous print. They were for James Joyce to look at when he was recording this record, you see, because his sight was so bad, and Ogden got the idea, well, look, we can use these cards and they'll be easy to read. There it is. And then that sing-song voice of his in the record, Joyce, well, you know, don't you know, Kennett, I haven't told you every telling as a tale. Well, there it is, these great big letters, you couldn't possibly miss it. But it seems from what Ogden told me that after a bit he got tired of that and rattled it off by heart. But these cards are very interesting, actually.
When did you first meet Ogden?
I first met Ogden with Munnings in 51, 52. Yeah. And for the last 6 years of his life, 5 years of his life, we saw each other 2 or 3 times a week. I attended to all his affairs, insofar as they impinged on the law, and learnt a great deal from him, as he learnt a certain amount, I hope, from me.
Did Ogden discuss any of his philosophic ideas with you at that time?
A very hard man to get any discussion out of. He was a man who provoked discussion. He got the best out of you. He was marvellous at that sort of thing, no matter who it was. And he was marvellous at getting all sorts of people around him at the club. I won't mention its name, where he met mostly. He'd get all sorts of people who'd normally never talk to each other. And they'd be chatting and chattering away and giving off their views. And there was never any silences about when Ogden was around. It was an extraordinary thing. He said very little and never participated in the conversation as such. Occasionally mumbled a few words, but it sparkled, and people gave him it's an uncanny gift the man had of getting the best out of him. Whether it was writing, I never wrote a better letter than when I was writing for Ogden, and suggestions that he'd sort of throw out, or when you were talking to him. So you say, what was he like to talk to? It was hardly a discussion so much. It was more getting you to talk.
Did he, in fact, give many public lectures?
Very seldom. I, the only one I know that he ever gave was the one to at the University of Gower Street, University of London, when they embalmed the body of thingamajig, Jeremy Bentham.
Yes.
His one great hero, Ogden's one great hero, Jeremy Bentham. And Ogden gave the lecture on Jeremy Bentham. It's been published in one of these series of his, and a very good lecture on it is. And he's very funny, because I think he gave half of it in basic English and nobody knew it until he told them.
I think it might be interesting to say something about Ogden's basic English, because I believe at the time there were a number of people interested in it, people like Joyce and Shaw, and even I remember Churchill was worked actively on its promotion at one point.
It's a vast subject. There, it practically killed him. It was an idea he got, he exclusively. There was trouble with I.A. Richards over it, which is a great shame, for they were very, very great friends. And Richards was one of the basic English workers and took it to China and all over the world and back and then to America. But they quarreled because in America, Richards wanted to vary the system. The system was basically of 850 words, rules, to enable foreign students to learn English very quickly, and his idea was it would become an international second language, but all the world would then be speaking basic English, do you see? Basic English started in the 20s, and the quarrel started in the 40s, when Churchill and Roosevelt together tried to put it across as a second international, as an international second language. And this having happened in America, the Americans cottoned onto it first and naturally inquired of Richards, for they knew that Richards was a supporter of it and a propagandist for it. And whether he I'm quite sure he didn't do it deliberately, but he certainly gave the impression, or the Americans somehow received the impression, that he was the inventor of basic English. And once that got around, Churchill made the mistake and said it was by Ogden and Richards. It was accepted as gospel. And although Richards wrote to the Times and said that really this must stop, I had nothing whatever to do with the invention of basic English. It was solely and exclusively Ogden's idea, and the working out of it, which cost him an enormous effort in time and stress, is entirely his.
How did he get on with Russell?
They were great friends. Stay together. They were very great friends, he and Dora Russell and the family. They wrote to each other on that, in that way, come down, Dora, Dora expects you, and so forth. And Ogden would say, how's the regards to the family and the rest. He never wrote Dear Bertie, I noticed. It was always Dear Russell and Dear Ogden. They never got on familiar terms like that. I was wondering whether I had anything here which... Oh, no, that's a thing from Ezra Pound. Here's a letter from Ezra Pound to him. Pound got very interested in basic English and supported it for a long time. But he... You can't describe this thing. You have to see it to believe it. Just look at it. This great big image of Pound, I suppose he did the drawing himself, and printed in square at the middle there, Anno... and then in Roman numerals 16 via Marsala 12.5, what does that mean? That's just the address. E. Pound Rapallo, 26 September, no year given. Dear Ogden, from my point of view, you are a goddamn chump. You didn't stand up to remarks in my note in Chinese written character, oblique. You did not mix and converse when I gave you the chance, another oblique. Like the whole goddamn little wad of defunct Britons, you try to make a set and snobbism. They were great friends. But he says, you simply aren't worth a grown man's time, despite your excellent essay on Bacon and the other merits you have shown. Now listen to this one. Richard is an ape. Oblique. And I'm not going to take time out to go through, and he spells through THRU, you know, and your, YR. Your whole series. When I did read it carefully, I found your goddamn students had read merely manuals and textbooks. You yourself have not read my ABC of reading, or you wouldn't, as the damn, as, you wouldn't ask, I suppose you mean, you wouldn't ask the damn silly questions you do ask. In your series, the explorer bloke had some concrete knowledge. Knowledge of particulars. Oh, these underlinings. The mutts who talk about literature had not examined particular masterwork. They had read treatises or listened to lectures. Naturally, a man like Richards, fundamental lack of sensibility won't help you. Fundamental non-perception is incurable. I hope all this isn't libelous. It is catered to in the... Listen to this. It is catered to in the shitten universe system of England and America, and he spells it Eng and Am. Old story of the gases and the fish holds for reading matter. Reading Richards is less use to learner than reading Homer or Shakespeare. He's running around Shakespeare now, is he? No one has been annoying me since the original annoyance caused by some of your series and your own failure to face the note in Chai Rit Cha. This has something to do with his some Chinese idea he had. Naturally, you have not been able to get your students to take in all you yourself know. I suppose it was One Year Flock at Sixth Renewal, who surprised a friend by reading my ABC very quickly. It was then discovered that what had been read was my comment only, omitting, this will go on forever, omitting the given samples. You know, for a great man, he wrote a lot of tosh, didn't he, this Jim Pound? Well, I don't know whether it's worth going on with this stuff. A lot of it is drivel. Ogden, I gather, I think, somewhere or other, I've got an answer to this, which is very precise and to the point and coherent and friendly nonetheless, and brings him up to the... Oh, here we are. Dear Pound, this, oh, it was in 1938. Bad time, wasn't it? Just before the war. Dear Pound, I'm sorry to find you have been annoyed, however arbitrarily, but I don't see that you need take it out on basic English. I asked you for your reasons for printing the statement that basic English is feeble in concrete illustration. You reply, Richard is an ape, and I'm not going to take time out to go through your whole series. Apparently anyone who has read your ABC should have expected that answer, and a friend of yours is a witness that I did. But is it an answer? As to publicity in English, You've never suggested that you had any use for publicity in other languages. What languages do you refer to? What did you expect me to do about what as regards Chinese written character? I find... I suppose that's what he means about chai writ car. What did you expect me to do about... And about what? That's what he means as regards Chinese written character. I find nothing concrete about this in any letter you've written or elsewhere. Since Richards has been chiefly in China for the last 5 years, and I've not seen him for more than a few hours, or been able to get letters to him for more than 18 months, I can't regard the fact that it would be more use to read Homer than his works has as much to do with my specific query as you suppose. As far as I remember, he was the first to make that remark, so why not be content to attribute it to him? I'm glad you don't blame me for Brit Art Crit. That is at least something, but you suppose to me to have students. Why? Has someone at sixth remove told you that I'm at Cambridge, or do you imagine that lectures are given at the Orthological Institute? Answer, you don't know and you don't care. But why should a grown man use silly words merely because he's heard someone reading Dante as if it was prose? Is not this almost as good an example of couch as the suggestion that Hopkins was concerned with metrical experiments? Where could you get that from, if not by reading his works as prose? Or do your students continue to confuse meter with rhythm? Yours sincerely, C.K. Alden. That's a good, sharp, short response. I wish I'd had the response to that one. Oh, you couldn't catch Ogden out on matters of that sort. He really knew his stuff. I mean, what have I got here now? All sorts of correspondence with what was known as the Black Sun Press. Wasn't that something to do... Wasn't that the press that originally published James Joyce? I rather think it was. 29, this is, Paris, May the 3rd. From... Harry and Caress Crosby. They were the editors of this thing called Edition Narcisse, the Black Sun Press. He was asked to do a preface to one of Joyce's books, Ogden was, and he says here, Harry Crosby says about his wife Caress, I suppose, Caress is very busy today, so I'm writing to you about one small change, if you agree, in your preface, which Joyce is very glad to have, and which we all think is very fine. I certainly congratulate you. Yours was no easy task. Do you remember where you say, referring to Stephenson, page 5, he tells me that it was only after 6 years of constant study and practice that he attained proficiency in its use, that is, the Eskimo language, so far so good. Then you write, so at least 6 days may be necessary before Mr. Joyce's word ballet yields its secret, even to an adjusted mind. Entre nous, I think Joyce felt a little sensitive about this last sentence, because although you probably didn't mean it, it sounds as if the word ballet was, this is handwritten by the way, was of very little consequence. Only 1/365 as something, the Eskimo original. Forgive me if I suggest this be altered. Perhaps the sentence could be put in the form of a question, and so on. I suppose Joyce may have been very touchy about something he said there. This Black Sun Press was publishing one of Joyce's books or pamphlets, and Ogden writing a preface to it. It's a smallish, probably works in progress or something of that sort. The date of this letter is the 3rd of May, Paris, the 3rd of May, 1929. I spent all this morning going over proofs with Joyce. My head is whirling with words and symbols, so please forgive this rather incoherent letter. I have something you will... No, I hope someday you'll come to Paris. He has a rather odd signature. He not only writes his name, he then does a little face and rays of the sun, Black Sun Press. Dear Ogden, this is April 29. Our press is bringing out in the spring an edition de luxe of fragments of James Joyce's work in progress. That's what it was, work in progress. Now appearing in the magazine Transition. And then he asks whether he'd be good enough to do the preface to it.